Okay, before I start, somebody in the class pointed out to me that there was an ambiguity in the syllabus about when the second part of the final, the take-home essay, is due. It's going to, I said Wednesday, and then I gave a date that was corresponding to that Thursday, but it's actually due on that Wednesday, the Wednesday of finals week. So I'll send out an email to the class, you know, clarifying all of this. Okay, if you remember, on Friday I began talking about the Kennedy period. And this is really the climactic period of the whole Cold War. The story of what happened during the Kennedy period is complex. It has all these different elements, both political and military. And actually, I need two full lectures to kind of sort these things out. I didn't even bother doing a new outline for the class today because it's the same outline as Friday. It's just picking up where I left off then. If you recall what the basic framework is, we're interested in this whole question of what the Cold War was about, how a stable international order came into being during the Cold War period, and to kind of get at that, we look at these various points during the history of this period when it seemed that a settlement was within reach. A set of arrangements seemed to be on the verge of coming into being that everybody could live with. And if that was the case, you know, if those arrangements had been accepted by everybody, then you would have had a perfectly stable system. But the first three times that it seemed that a settlement was within reach, just like a year or two later, you just move into a period of very sharp tensions, a period of crisis. And the third of those three times was 1954, the system established by the Paris Accords. Why didn't that work? You know, you'd think it could have laid the basis for a stable international order, right? Because it solved the two great problems that lay at the heart of international politics, the Russian problem and the German problem. You had a strong NATO system in Western Europe based on a large American military presence in Western Europe. That NATO structure based on American power could provide an effective counterweight to Soviet power in Europe. They couldn't dream of invading and conquering Western Europe without triggering a Third World War, which was a much worse prospect than simply living with the status quo. On the other hand, it also solved the German problem because German power was contained within a structure dominated by the United States. Germany's non-nuclear status was a very important part of the Paris Accord system. So we asked, why didn't it work? Not because the Soviets wouldn't accept it, not because the Germans wouldn't accept it. It had to do with American policy, and in particular with the Eisenhower policy. The Eisenhower policy of pulling out of Europe and getting the Europeans to stand on their own as a third great power bloc in world affairs, to use his own term, to get the Europeans to provide for their own defense. And obviously, the only way they could defend themselves against a great nuclear power like the USSR was by building up a nuclear capability of their own, an independent nuclear capability. And given the absence of a true United States of Europe, a true federal union in Western Europe, a true pooling of sovereignty, any so-called European nuclear force would essentially be a simple knitting together of forces that are ultimately under national control. They'd be coordinated within some supranational structure, but they would be ultimately under the control of the national governments, and in particular the German government. Right? And there's no question, this is one of the most important findings of historical research over the last 20 years on these issues, there's no question, you know, that the Germans wanted to develop a nuclear force of that sort. The German Chancellor at this time, the great founding Chancellor of the Federal Republic of Germany, Konrad Adenauer, he said in the German cabinet in 1957, with regard to nuclear weapons, we must produce them. Right? All the more so since you couldn't count on America to protect you forever. You know, the whole U.S. strategy, you know, it was fairly clear. They had this code term for American withdrawal from Europe. It was called redeployment. The American top American officials were constantly talking about this sort of thing, and often this would get leaked to the press and, you know, create all kinds of problems. The Europeans understood that there was a good chance that the Americans might pull out, and if that's the case, they would be naked against the USSR. Didn't they need to kind of protect themselves? You know, all this stuff is, it's obvious. You have to understand, there's nothing wrong with countries like Germany and France and Britain wanting to develop nuclear forces of their own. You know, they would not want to trust their destiny so totally to a foreign power like the United States, no matter how well intentioned. And the Eisenhower administration pursued this policy of nuclear sharing, helping the Europeans, including the Germans, develop a nuclear capability. Right? That's so the 1954 system didn't work because the Americans wouldn't go along with it. And this meant, naturally, that the Soviets would be very concerned about what was going on, because it seemed that West Germany was moving quite rapidly to becoming a nuclear power. And in fact, by the end of the Eisenhower period, the West Germans had a significant number of American nuclear weapons under their control. Not officially, but de facto. Right? The Berlin crisis that began in November 1958 has to be understood in that context. No other interpretation of that crisis makes sense. Right. It wasn't that Soviets wanted a war, not even that they wanted to kick the Western powers out of Berlin. They weren't even primarily concerned with the stability of the East German state. Because the East Germans would say, well, you know, we could deal with the hemorrhage of the caused by the fact that East German citizens could so easily take, you know, move to West Germany through Berlin. East Germans said, we could deal with that by sealing the border. And the Soviets said, no, we don't want to do that because we have bigger fish to fry, basically. We want to keep this Berlin thing alive because it's important for us as a lever. You know, and as I say, just one look at the map, and you could see why Berlin, West Berlin, this Western enclave in the middle of communist East Germany, is a very effective lever that the Soviets have. That's how they used it in 1948, and they're using it this way again. It's to force the Western powers to take account of Soviet concerns about Germany and talk about these things. But Eisenhower was unwilling to give the Soviets what they really wanted, although he was by no means intransigent, no means truculent about these issues. But in terms of guaranteeing that West Germany would have non-nuclear status and going hand in hand with that, guaranteeing that the United States would remain in Europe on an indefinite basis, no way, as far as Eisenhower was concerned, right? And when it became clear what the U.S. strategy was, the Soviets put the whole issue on the back burner for the balance of the Eisenhower period and waited for the change of administrations in 1961 to see what could be done, what could be worked out. Okay. So the Kennedy administration comes to power in 1961. And there is a very dramatic change in policy. What is that change, right? You look at a lot of the textbooks that have been written on the subject, and people say, well, under Eisenhower, we had a strategy of massive retaliation. And under Kennedy, the strategy became one of flexible response. Massive retaliation meant Soviets do something we don't like, then it's start World War III. Execute the PSYOPs, send the, all these American bombers and missiles and so on to attack the targets in the Soviet Union, wipe them out. In terms of explosive power, U.S. arsenal was at a maximum at the end of the Eisenhower period in 1960, right? The size of the weapons was, very, very great. The strategic weapons were enormous, and it was like just let it go. No talk of limiting the attack and having very discriminate targeted strategies where your goal was to avoid collateral damage. Eisenhower said, that's just, you're just kidding yourself if you think you could fight a war in that nice, neat way in the nuclear age, right? And the idea is, well, under Kennedy, they took a different view. They said, well, we don't want to just have this just big one-shot nuclear attack. We're just throwing everything we have at them in a single blow. We want to fight the war in a more controlled, more discriminate way. And in particular, we don't want to rely so heavily on nuclear weapons. We want to kind of go through a phase of conventional escalation before we use nuclear weapons, partly because this would make nuclear escalation more automatic, and it wouldn't depend on a decision to a conscious, cool, and deliberate decision to start a third world war that might well be suicidal. We want it to be semi-automatic, right? This is the notion behind flexible response. And so we'll build up our conventional forces in Europe, and we'll use them in the event of a conflict, and the more heavily we get involved in the conventional level, the more likely it is that the president will be under enormous pressure to escalate rather than see these large American conventional forces destroyed. Semi-automatic escalation. All right, so there's a lot of stuff like that at the level of strategic theory. The Eisenhower administration had massive retaliation, the Kennedy administration flexible response. Yes?
Wasn't that mostly because conventional warfare, like the Soviets would win over on Western Europe, like every time?
Yes, but you're not going to fight a conventional war without using nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons would be there in the background, and they would be in everybody's mind. And the Soviets would have to take that into account in determining how they would fight a war. In particular, if you can target Soviet forces in the field, You could prevent them from concentrating their forces, because if they concentrated their forces, they would be this target of nuclear attack. But in order to have offensive military operations, you have to concentrate. So a conventional conflict fought in the shadow of nuclear weapons, it's by no means as lopsided as I think you were suggesting. It was by no means absurd to think that the West could hold its own, even in the kind of conventional conflict that was likely to be fought, where nuclear weapons were playing this big role in the background. My point is, this is a conventional view. Massive retaliation under Eisenhower, flexible response under Kennedy. It's therefore something of a surprise when you go into the documents and you find that, not quite as simple as that. The Eisenhower strategy had been changing in the course of the 1950s, moving toward greater flexibility, greater emphasis on non-nuclear response, at least in the earlier stages of conflict. In 1960, the last full year of the Eisenhower administration, the key U.S. officials, Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, actually used the term flexibility of response to characterize what they wanted in their forces. The dynamics here are actually quite interesting, because by talking in terms of heavy emphasis on nuclear weapons, you're convincing the other side that there's little point to maintaining large conventional forces. Because in the event of war, everything's going to become nuclear anyway, so what good are your conventional forces going to be? And there's this extraordinary build-down of the Soviet conventional forces during the late 1950s, the first half of the Khrushchev period, right? Which actually had the effect of making a non-nuclear defense of Western Europe more viable, more possible. So these dynamics are actually more complex than you might think. But the real point is the Eisenhower administration, in terms of its basic strategic thinking, was not nearly a simple-minded believer in massive retaliation as it's normally portrayed as being. When you look at the thinking about operational strategy, what would we do if Berlin were cut off? What would we do if an armed conflict broke out in Europe, you know? The line between the Eisenhower strategy and the Kennedy strategy is not nearly as sharp as we've been led to believe. That Kennedy thought that in the final analysis, you know, if fighting breaks out over Berlin, we'll have to use nuclear weapons. And the sort of planning for a Berlin crisis that was worked out under the Eisenhower, under the Kennedy period, was similar to what it had been under Eisenhower, which is to say, you start little, you know, with sending a platoon down the Autobahn from West Germany to West Berlin. If that gets blocked, you raise the level of military operations, you know, battalion, and then all the way up to under Eisenhower to a full reinforced division, which is a fairly substantial force. And if the enemy attacks that division, then in the terms of the Eisenhower Secretary of Defense, the fat is in the fire, it means World War III, we're going to open up with everything we have. Okay? So there's a phase of, fairly significant conventional military operations. Not enough to win a war in itself, but enough to pose that sort of risk to the enemy so that the enemy would draw back. The whole idea that they stop a couple of jeeps on the Autobahn, it's the balloon goes up, it means World War III, not true. Now in Kennedy administration, the strategy was essentially the same. The whole escalatory process, the non-nuclear phase of the escalatory process, it would last a little longer and go a little further. Not just to a full division, but to a three-division force, a full army corps. You know, it was this, you know, but one division's three divisions, you know, it's not a fundamental conceptual shift. Okay. Where then is the conceptual shift? Why then is the Kennedy administration's policy so different from that of Eisenhower? Indeed, so different that it made a peaceful settlement possible. Okay? It was in the area of U.S.-European relations, not general nuclear strategy, but U.S.-European relations. And whereas Eisenhower wanted the Europeans to be strong and self-reliant, and he was unwilling to dictate to them, and he viewed himself as kind of like this honest broker trying to pull together the different countries in the alliance who were taking very different lines. Under Kennedy, it's very different. The whole Kennedy approach, much more nationalistic, right? We are going to determine policy. We are going to determine strategy. We are going to decide how far we're going to go in terms of making concessions with the other side, right? We are the ones who are going to determine what would happen in the event of a war, how the war would be conducted, how military force would be used. And the we means not the Americans in some sort of general way, but the political leadership in Washington, the president and his top advisors, their want to concentrate control in their own hands. You know, take it away from the military, withdraw from the pre-delegation arrangements of the Eisenhower period, make sure that the key decisions are made by the political authorities in Washington, not by the U.S. military officers in the field, not by, let alone by the European governments. the three big NATO allies, West Germany, France, and Britain. Now, what's the thinking here that underlies this? It's that, yes, right now, we could maintain our position in all these exposed areas like West Berlin by threatening to escalate, by threatening general nuclear war, you know, in a gradual way. But that situation is not gonna last forever. People were surprised that it had lasted as long as it had. It's not that hard for a major power like the USSR to develop a survivable nuclear capability. It's very hard, for the same reason, for a country like the United States, no matter how much it spends, no matter how much of an effort it makes, to hold on to something like a first strike capability, the ability, if we struck hard enough and fast enough at the beginning of a war, to so destroy the enemy's retaliatory capability that we would not suffer really heavy damage in the course of the war. We, meaning both the United States and even the NATO allies. It's very hard to hold on to something like that. So the end of American nuclear superiority, it's on the horizon, it's just a couple years off. And when that happens, Berlin is going to be indefensible because we can only protect our position there by threatening nuclear escalation. And since that's going to be suicidal, our threats are not going to be credible, and we're going to be heading for, you know, real problems. So we got to solve this thing before we lose our bargaining leverage entirely, and we got to kind of work out some sort of arrangement with the Soviets. And for Kennedy, you know, there's no reason why a settlement can't be reached. A set of understandings can't be worked out between East and West, right? His whole notion, and this is the basic philosophy that he lays out to the Soviet leader, Nikita Khrushchev, when they meet at Vienna in June of 61, is you're a great power, we're a great power. We gotta deal with each other on a business-like basis, each one respecting the power of the other. Right, we understand your concerns about Germany, meaning German nuclear capability. We understand your special interests in Eastern Europe, right? But you have to understand we have major interests in Europe too. We want to maintain the status quo in Europe. We have a particular stake in maintaining the status quo in Berlin. Let's make a deal on that basis. You know, you respect the status quo, we'll respect the status quo, we'll keep Germany non-nuclear, you respect our presence in West Berlin. We can end the Cold War on that basis. That's the Kennedy line. Yeah.
Kennedy know that the Soviets wanted to keep Germany out of nuclear weapons while Eisenhower didn't
feel like it? This whole issue of what is the basic Soviet concern here. The Soviets often expressed that view that they deeply objected to Germany going nuclear, but they didn't say, this is the taproot, this is the heart of our thing. So a lot of this stuff is supposition. Eisenhower was willing to kind of ride out whatever objections the Soviets had because they weren't strong enough to start a war, and he was so committed to his basic philosophy. Kennedy, it's not so much that they did an analysis and looked through all the data that they had showing what was in the minds of the Soviet leaders. They didn't want Germany to have nuclear weapons without regard to the Soviets. Just they didn't trust the Germans. The Kennedy people felt like if Germany became nuclear, it would create all kinds of problems for us, not just for the Soviets. And so we didn't want that either. We wanted to keep nuclear weapons out of the hands of the Germans. And this whole notion of, is a settlement of the Soviet Union possible? It didn't turn on, oh, we're willing to give him this thing about German nuclear weapons. Played a certain role, but it's a general vision of how can the two sides get along with each other? Each of them respects the other. right? Two great powers, each power balances the power of the other. That's the whole thing. Rather than focusing too specifically on this, these particular substantive issues, right? So this is the Kennedy thing. Look how different it is from Eisenhower. Eisenhower wanted to get out. Kennedy understands you can't get out. Eisenhower thought the Europeans should come together in some sort of federal union, United States of Europe. Kennedy thinks that's pie in the sky. It's not going to happen, and you know, for, you know, if it happens at all, it's not going to happen for decades. Right? Given that that's the case, there's no purely European solution to the European security problem. The counterweight to Soviet power has to be built on a continuing American presence. A continuing American presence is necessary if Germany is to be kept non-nuclear, because otherwise, how can you contain the Soviets? Right? So Kennedy has a certain sense for how he wants to proceed. America has to stay in Europe on a permanent basis. We're stuck there. Okay? We're stuck in Europe. But given that we're stuck in Europe, given that our own neck is on the chopping block, basically, given that we're moving into a world of nuclear parity where who knows how the Soviets will behave, because American preeminence will then be a thing of the past. Given all of these things, we have certain rights. If we're going to basically protect Western Europe, if we're going to play that role, we should essentially, you know, shape policy for the West as a whole. Right. Yeah, George Bundy, Kennedy's national security advisor, he said, we have to pay the price of leadership. We may as well get some of the benefits, right? If we are running the risk of nuclear escalation, then we have to play the key role on the Western side of whatever process there is that could lead to a general war. We should set policy for the West as a whole, and we should also concentrate the means of implementing policy in our own hands. Yeah. Yeah, at the end, and as a matter of fact, Acheson was brought back into the Kennedy administration as a very important advisor. And Acheson was the one that basically shaped the strategy of the new administration in 1961. Okay, the key thing is, you know, America's there. You know, we're committing our power. This could lead us into a war. Well, we want to not just sit on our hands and let this process that leads to war just unfold on its own. We want to make sure that we have real input, as a matter of fact, the leading role in determining the Western side of that strategy. And if you're going to have that sort of power, you need to control the nuclear forces of the West as a whole. You have to concentrate everything in American hands, and in particular in the hands of the political authorities in Washington. So in 1961, a whole slew of new policies is introduced. And a lot of these things are summed up in all these acronyms that people used at the time, right? C-cubed, so that means command, control, and communication. Huge investment in making sure that communications between the military authorities in Europe and the political leaders in Washington was maintained intact. Because if the enemy was able to, or in the course of a war, communications broke down, then authority would devolve to the commanders that had physical control. You didn't want that. You didn't want these military officers to be using nuclear weapons at their own free will. You wanted to control these things. Permissive action links. These are nuclear locks. These are locks that you put on these American nuclear weapons to prevent unauthorized use. You need codes to be sent out from the central authorities that would enable people to unlock the PALs and make the weapons usable. Right? The whole idea here is to withdraw from this de facto nuclear sharing that had taken place under Eisenhower. All these American nuclear weapons that the Allies were able to use, you know, not legally, but de facto, Now it would take a conscious decision from the American authorities to allow them to have that that power. These PALs were put not just on the weapons that had been deployed to the Allied forces, but even to the American land forces, American air forces based on the European continent. Not to American naval vessels, but you didn't want to have too sharp a discrimination between the Americans in Europe and the Allied forces in Europe. So you also put PALs on the American weapons that are controlled by American forces in Europe. SACUR. That's the Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, General Norstad, in this period. Under Eisenhower, and I talked about this in the lecture on MC-48, under Eisenhower, SACUR had this pre-delegated authority to order nuclear strikes without first getting the green light from Washington under certain circumstances. There are these kind of very general pre-delegation letters that were issued. This was very important because it served to assuage the concerns of the Europeans that, to a certain degree, that the Americans would never escalate to the level of general nuclear war, and therefore the American deterrent threat was hollow, and that the Europeans couldn't trust America and so on. Pre-delegation basically said, look, here's this American general. He's thinking day in, day out about the defense of Europe. In a sense, he's more European than any of the Europeans are. He's more likely to use nuclear weapons than the president in Washington. This should be a source of reassurance for you. Now all this stuff is changed a bit, not so much the formal delegations, but the de facto arrangements that came into being. SACUR's wings are clipped. General Norstad is essentially fired for trying to be too autonomous. MRBMs, these are land-based medium-range ballistic missiles. They're based in Western Europe. They're capable of hitting targets in Soviet territory. The plan had been to deploy these things on the territory of the Allied States, in particular West Germany, these MRBMs. Now the argument was that they could too easily fall under the control of the host nation. We didn't want to risk that. So all these plans to deploy MRBMs in Western Europe, they're shelved. We're not going to do it. Again, moving away from this whole notion of Western Europe having this kind of autonomous ability to use nuclear weapons on their own. And the weaker they are, the more dependent they are on America, the more control is concentrated in the hands of the political authorities in Washington. The MLF, they came up with this plan, as actually came up with it under the Eisenhower administration. The MLF is called means multilateral force, and this was a plan to for a naval force armed with nuclear weapons to be constructed, and the naval force would be manned by contingents from all kinds of different NATO countries, even in a single ship. The whole idea was this would eventually give the Europeans more of a feeling of nuclear participation. And under Eisenhower, the idea of the MLF would be that the Europeans would ultimately control this force on their own. It wouldn't be subject to American veto. That policy was changed under Kennedy. Now the MLF, these weapons on the MLF could only be used if the U.S. consented. The U.S. veto was maintained intact. And so, you know, Kennedy thought, like, well, so how does this give the Europeans anything? It really doesn't give them anything. The use of these weapons is subject to American control. That's why the French took to calling the multilateral force. They called it the multilateral farce because it was just so absurd that it could, you know, have any strategic value at all if it was subject to an American veto. And Kennedy basically shared that view, by the way. British and French nuclear weapons. This is a very important part of the story. It's a basic principle of U.S. policy during the Kennedy period. Striking change from what had been under Eisenhower. No German finger on the nuclear trigger. But if you're going to say no to the Germans, How could you say yes to the French? That would be just so discriminatory. But if you weren't going to say yes to the French, if you weren't going to support the idea of a French nuclear force, then how could you continue cooperating with the British? Britain is a nuclear power. France had just become a nuclear power. Right. So you have to say no to the British as well, because you can't discriminate among allies. That's the whole idea. You can't single out the Germans for discriminatory treatment. And so you're going to have to oppose the British nuclear force and oppose the French nuclear force. In other words, make these countries, all the big European countries, make them totally dependent on the United States. Okay. If you were French, if you were British, you were German, you don't like this stuff at all. You don't like the idea of basically having your fangs pulled. You know, you no longer have, you know, any independent status in world affairs. You're totally dependent on America with this conception. Okay. What else? Nuclear doctrine. The U.S. Secretary of Defense at that time, very important figure in the story, Robert McNamara, he came up with this nuclear doctrine, which he presented to the Allies at a NATO conference at Ann Arbor a NATO conference at Athens and a public speech at Ann Arbor in the spring of 1962. And the whole idea was, instead of this one-shot plan of fighting a nuclear war, we're going to fight it in a more controlled and discriminating way. We're going to have such accurate weapons that we can destroy the enemy's nuclear forces without causing all kinds of huge collateral damage to the enemy's civilian population. We're going to avoid cities, because as long as we avoid hitting their cities and killing large numbers of their civilian population, then that gives them this huge incentive to avoid attacking us with whatever they have left and destroying our own cities. Right? This is called, and so we can coerce them. We can gradually, you know, destroy their nuclear forces. And once their nuclear forces are destroyed, they'll be at our mercy. And while this war is going on, they will have every incentive to hold back from retaliating against our cities. Right? Seems like a very subtle, intelligent sort of strategy. Thing is, McNamara didn't believe in any of this. Right. He didn't take any of this seriously. He didn't think that a war could actually be fought in that way. The whole point of the official strategy, controlled response it was called, this was the nuclear component of the general flexible response strategy, was that it provided a rationale for centralization of control over nuclear war fighting in the hands of the authorities in Washington, and thus a rationale for the American policy of opposing European nuclear forces. Okay. That's in the military sphere. Everything is concentrated in the hands of the authorities in Washington, or at least that's their dream. In the political sphere, we make it clear to the Europeans that they're going to have to follow the American lead. Kennedy wrote, and he didn't write too many of these memoranda, but there's this memo, the Europeans are going to have to come along or fall behind, he said in late 1961. America is laying down the law to the Europeans. Right? This is quite astonishing. And what it meant was, on the one hand, it seemed that the path is now open to a negotiated settlement with the Soviets, because now we're serious. Now we're giving them what they really most want, namely keeping Germany from becoming nuclear. German power will be contained within this NATO structure, the structure dominated by the United States. The number one Soviet security need, the control of German power. Kennedy is offering it to them. And frankly, it would have been so nice if, when Kennedy had laid this out to Khrushchev at Vienna in June of 61, the Soviet leader just say, great, let's just wrap things up. Let's work out a deal on that basis. The problem is that the more you go to this route, the more you're abandoning positions that the West had taken earlier. Right. And in particular that the West German government had taken earlier. We're willing to accept your control of Eastern Europe. We're willing to accept the communist regime in East Germany. We're willing to do all these things to improve the nature of our relations with them, to act toward them as though they were kind of almost a legitimate state and so on, de facto diplomatic recognition and so on. All these things are taken as signs of weakness by the Soviets. And it undercuts their incentive to kind of strike a deal with the Americans, right? The laying on the Berlin crisis had enabled them to make certain gains, to extract certain concessions from the West. Well, you know, let the process continue. If we'd been able to get so much up to this point, you know, just let's give the tree another shake and see what apples fall out. That sort of thing. Okay. So this is what happens. Kennedy presents these ideas to Khrushchev at Vienna. The Soviets take this really intransigent line, you know, like Khrushchev trying to bully the young president. And then the U.S. President comes back. The U.S. government thinks, what are we going to do? He's threatening to, bring the Berlin business to a head by the end of the year. They think very seriously about their military options, but also their political options. President Kennedy gives this very tough speech to the nation the following month, July of 1961, contemplating escalation to the level of nuclear war. Soviets now get scared. And they respond in August of 1961, the following month, by building the Berlin Wall, by sealing off Berlin. Now, if you're looking for something that would symbolize Soviet acceptance of the status quo in Berlin, in Germany, and in Europe in general, you couldn't ask for anything better than a wall. What could better symbolize the separate status of East or West Berlin? If you want to take over West Berlin, you're not going to build a wall, right? This is the Soviets throwing in the towel. And when they do it, they make it clear to the West that whatever happens, the access rights of the Western powers to West Berlin will not be affected, right? But that's not exactly how the American government interpreted it. This is an extraordinary example, I think, of misinterpretation. They didn't view the Berlin Wall as symbolizing Soviet acceptance of the status quo. They viewed it in exactly the opposite light. For them, it meant the Soviets were aggressive. They had done this unilaterally. This one unilateral action could easily foreshadow further unilateral actions. There was a real risk that if nothing were done, matters would drift to the point of an armed conflict. And so therefore, the American idea is we got to move much more forcefully toward negotiations. And so the Americans in late 1961 give the appearance of practically being panicking. We got to negotiate with the Soviets. President Kennedy had said, we cannot negotiate with those who say what's mine is mine and what's yours is negotiable. That was in that July 1961 speech. But now this is precisely what the American government is proposing to do, because the Soviets are saying that, and now we're saying you got to negotiate with them. So all this stuff leads to this big crisis in the Western alliance. A crisis between the United States and the two main continental European allies, France and Germany, right? Germany by herself can't take too independent a line, because for Germany to be too independent, Germany to demand nuclear weapons and so on, the whole rest of the world, including people in the West, are going to say, there the Germans go again, look how nationalistic they are, and so on. But if the policy of resisting America could be presented not as nationalistic, but as European, as supranational, and so on, it's much easier for German government to resist. And this is why the French policy during this period is so important. Earlier, France had taken pretty much the same policy as the United States. Now the French are very upset. Not because they differ with Kennedy substantively about what the end point should be, but they disagree with the way the Americans are managing the western side of the crisis. The Americans are giving away too much, too fast, and thus leading not to peace, but rather to increased Soviet intransigence. So there's big crisis in the West. The nuclear thing, where the United States wants to kind of basically infantilize the Europeans, emasculate them, and now this policy that the Kennedy administration is pursuing that seems to like reflect a kind of appeasement mentality. This leads to this big crisis. So we have this whole problem with the European allies, and we haven't been able to kind of reach any agreement with the Soviets. Because if we could have reached it, we could have rammed it down the throats of the Europeans. That was the intention. But it failed vis-a-vis the Soviets, and the strategy that had been adopted in 61 is also ruining our relations with the main allies. Okay. So then what happens? 1962 is when all this stuff comes to a head. The Americans proceed. They want to kind of reach a deal with the Soviets. The key thing here is a document that they present to the Soviets in March of 1962. This is called the Principles Document. The Americans lay out these general principles for a settlement in Europe. And it's the basic Kennedy idea. Non-nuclear Germany, but this is rationalized in terms of a much more general desire on the part of the two major powers to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons. Acceptance of by both sides of the status quo in Europe, status quo in Germany, status quo around Berlin. Right? Soviet reaction? They're willing to take the concessions and then just kind of put them in the icebox, as our Secretary of State at that time said. Take the concessions, but not give any concessions. And this leads the American government, in the course of 1962, to harden its line. Okay? They come to the conclusion that a showdown with the Soviets is inevitable because they're so utterly intransigent. We had given them everything that they could reasonably ask for at the price of putting our own relations with our most important allies at risk. And even then, they're not willing to give anything in exchange. So a showdown with them is inevitable. That being the case, given the way the strategic balance is shifting, it's much better to have it out with them sooner rather than later. To have it out with them, to bring matters to a head, while we still have the upper hand in strategic terms, while we still can contemplate nuclear escalation before it becomes totally suicidal. Right? That is the context of the Cuban Missile Crisis. That's why the Cuban Missile Crisis is so important in this larger story. It's not this isolated event. People talk about it as though, yeah, it just kind of happened out of nowhere. It's a very dramatic two-week period, and then it kind of goes away without leaving any trace. That's totally wrong. It's an integral part of this larger story, the larger story of East-West relations, and could a stable peace be worked out? That whole notion of bring matters to a head with the Soviets sooner rather than later is clearly in President Kennedy's mind when he's informed in October 1962 that missiles had been discovered in Cuba. Okay, so I'm going to let a break here, and then next time I'll begin with the missile crisis, which is the climax of this whole Berlin affair, and talk about how in 1963, the elements of a stable international system were worked out.